From an open road and a road that's hidden, to the path you take and a path not taken. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I'm Jason Burns.
And I'm Danny Nucci, and this is the What About podcast. What about it?
What about your favorite teacher, Danny? I was thinking back, you know, we talked to our guest, Tony Danza, about somebody who made a mark on his life. Do you have one of those?
Well, you know, what's funny is I don't know how funny it is actually, but as I was gonna jump in and share my story with him, but it didn't seem appropriate at the moment. But yeah, there was a teacher named Myron Makowski, who I was in a beginning intro to acting class, and I read the first assignment was to write a little story. So I read the story, and he's like, "You're gonna be in my advanced acting class." I'm like, "No, I'm not." And he's like, "Yeah, you are." He puts me up against the fence. He goes, "You're gonna be in my class." And he was like a New York guy, right? Former actor, like, you know, was teaching in California. And
what grade is this? How old are you?
Got to be ninth grade. And he's eighth grade, maybe ninth grade. And he just, you know, was like, "You're going to be in my class." And I ended up doing, you know, the plays and falling in love with it. But yeah, same thing. He was like, "Yeah, you're going to be in my." I'm like, "All right." Same thing.
I feel like everybody who finds a passion, has a teacher somewhere along the way that sort of lights that fire. I had a couple that, you know, supported my writing even when I was super young, saying, "This is something you can keep doing this." It just feels like there's people who leave their mark on people without ever either realizing it or, you know, like, you know, we talked with Tony Danza about his teacher, Mr. Messenger, and how he's not here to this day, but he still references him at the end of a show, which I think is pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, what's the other thing that was parallel was I had a guy come up to me, said, "Hey, you want to be an actor?" Same exact thing.
Really?
That's how I ended up doing it. Yeah. So there's a lot of parallels there. But what a treat to talk to him. I mean, first of all, I can't say I talked to him. I could just listen to him. It was great. I didn't have to say anything. He was so generous and forthcoming and entertaining and charming as always.
Well, you can see why he has had such a successful career in sitcoms, because he's so affable, so charming, so, like, you just want to invite him into your home.
But he lets you in. I mean, like, you mm-hmm. know, which is great. He's so authentic.
And he could knock us all out if he wanted to.
He could knock us all out. So without further ado, boxer, actor, crooner, teacher, co-founder of Stars of Tomorrow, Tony Danza.
Have you ever had a run-in together with each other?
No, I don't think so, right? No.
No, but it's so funny. My wife I went upstairs. She goes, "Who's today?" I said, "Tony Danza." She goes, "Oh, I feel like I know him." I go, "I know. That's what he does." She's like, "Yeah." She's like, "That's what he does. Tell him I think he's really funny," which she is a sitcom actress. Her name's Paula Marshall.
One of the nicest things she could have said.
Yeah. And also, she hates, like, she says to me, "You're not funny." She goes, "Tony Danza's funny." I'm like, "Okay, thanks, babe."
Yikes. Well, Tony, you were born and raised in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Your dad's parents, I believe, were from Italy, and your mom was from Italy too.
That's right.
Can you paint a picture of what you know, a day in the life of your household was like? Was family dinner important, that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, did you eat a lot, Tony? Did you have a lot of food at the table?
Well, no, let me tell you, it was interesting. First of all, my father was a garbage man for the city. Mm-hmm. You know, Department of Sanitation. And back then, you know, it's interesting if you think about it. So many things have changed in our lives, but one of the things that changed is, you know, garbage men used to wear a uniform. Mm-hmm. He had a badge, they had hats. He'd have his hat in the back of his car. So he'd get a pass if something, you know, went untoward. I mean, it had a
relative amount of prestige.
Exactly,
yeah,
exactly. And people knew it was a good job and you got benefits. And he worked on the street that I lived on and went to school on. Oh, I should do a joke in my act that I was so proud of him because he used to drop me off at school with the truck. I'll never forget my first day of high school. He let me ride inside the truck. But anyway, you know, having him. So he came home at 4:30 after they stopped at the bar, you know, because at the end of the day, they would stop at a bar. You could tell there. You could actually tell how they were doing during the day by where which bar the truck was parked.
In. How far it got.
So anyway, he would come home at 4, and my mother worked in the city, and she would come home at like 6. And so he cooked every night for us, and he made, He made, and it's really why I cook, is because my father, I watch my father.
And we should point out you have a cookbook with your son as well,
with
right?
With my son, yeah. It's called Don't Fill Up on the Antipasta. Anyway, so he...
Great advice, by the way, which I never heed, but go on.
He would make a balanced meal for you every night. You would get a protein, you know, it's a steak, fish, something. You'd get a vegetable, potato, some kind of green, and then he'd make a salad every night, and he'd send me to go get the Italian bread, and I'd take off the end, and then he'd go, wait the end, you know, it was routine we did every night, and we had to be there for dinner.
And so he had it ready for when your mom came home?
And he had it ready. Oh, bitched and moaned, excuse me, but groaned and moaned about it. But he had it ready for her when she came
home. How many of you were there? Was it just, no, you had siblings?
Me and my brother. Yeah. Me and my brother, Matty. My 70-year-old kid brother. That's what he just turned 70. I says,
can you just stop with the 70? I mean, look at you. It's just not right.
Yeah, right. Let me tell you something. Somebody asked me the other day, hey, how's it feel to be 73? I says, it feels like I'm living in a bad neighborhood. Anything could happen.
It's true, right? It's like, yeah, all of a sudden, it's like, you're careful sneezing. It's horrible. Oh, this getting old shit is horrible.
So did you have like the big Sunday dinners with the extended family?
You know, I was just talking to my uncle. I still got an uncle out in Long Island. He's 97. His name is Philly Capasso. I mean, Philly Capasso, doesn't that name just scream pinky ring? He says to me the other day, he says, hey, you got to have macaroni on Sunday. You don't know what day it is otherwise. You know, you get mixed up the whole rest
of
the week.
Sure, of course.
We had Sunday sauce. You know, in fact, this week, I cooked and I made a big sauce yesterday. I made a big one so that I could freeze it into portions.
Oh, that's the best. It always tastes better when
but I got the next three Sundays taken care of. All I got to do is take it out, put it in there, macaroni.
Mm. In your spare time? That's what you're doing in your spare time? All the spare time you got, Tony?
I like to cook.
It's meditative to you. I wish I could do it. I'm just awful at it.
No, I love it.
The result is horrible, so the process becomes just tedious and awful for me.
It's such a... first of all, you know, when you can't think of anything else. You know, when you're chopping garlic, you really can't think of anything else.
You got to focus.
So I'm telling you, the thing about my father, he even made the Sunday sauce. He made everything. My mother cooked twice a year. She cooked the lasagna. Remember, it has an article. You know, you get the lasagna on Christmas and Thanksgiving. That was it. She made great lasagna. But my father cooked every night. And so I don't know. I watched him. I never forget. I was putting salt in something, and he yelled at me, "Don't be afraid." I said, "Okay." From now on, that became my new attitude. Don't be afraid.
But there's something kind of about that, Tony. Where, and I'm going to draw a connection to entertaining, is that when the end result is good, people enjoy it, and you can see their enjoyment, whether that's entertaining or cooking a good meal.
It's very creative as well. I mean, you know, my new thing is air fryers.
Oh my God.
I'm gone. You know what happened? We had a problem in the building upstairs, like 10 floors above me. Somebody drilled. They were renovating an apartment, and they drilled through the gas line. Excuse me.
Oh, man.
54 apartments, no gas for months because Con Ed has to come and back and forth. The wind-up of the story is
You adjusted and it saved your life.
I got an air fryer. It's the greatest thing. I haven't turned on the stove. I went and had a piece of wood made so I have more counter space. I haven't turned on the stove in 2 years.
Wow.
It's unbelievable. And the apartment's cleaner. The air, I mean, it is amazing. The best potatoes you ever tasted. The best corn on the cob you can't imagine.
I'm getting very hungry here. I'm getting very hungry.
I'm going to make pizza in it. Yeah, and I got a new thing. It's called, I want to make this my new snack hit. This is going to be the new hit. Okay? Better than potato chips. It's called Tony's Macaroni. And what it is air fry. You make macaroni. You make a pomodoro sauce, a little marinara sauce. Mm-hmm. You toss a pound of macaroni in it. And throw it in the air fryer and fry it down and get it crunchy. When Ooh. I tell you, this is I've been taking it around. I gave it some to my grandson to take to his high school.
Cheese? Do you put cheese on it? Is there cheese? Is there cheese on it, Tony?
Of course, you got to put a little.
Oh God, that sounds.
No, it's like a broiled macaroni and cheese, but without
fried, the air fried macaroni.
So, who was the performer in the family? Nobody. It was you. You just had a performative gene. Did you notice it in high school? Did you notice it
in high school?
When did you start going? You know what? I like this.
No, I always liked. I like to be.
You were always charming because that you can't learn. You have it or you don't have it. But was it just, did you start performing in plays or where did you notice it?
In high school, I had that teacher that comes along that makes a difference in your life. His name was Charles Messenger, my English teacher in the 11th grade. And he was my English teacher in the 11th grade, but in the 10th grade, I joined the musical. I had a little part. I was in the chorus. I was one of the dancers. It was Kiss Me, Kate. I played one. I think we did, what the hell was the song? Oh, Too Darn Hot. I think that was the song for her. Too Darn Hot. It's Too Darn Hot. Anyway, next year was Bye Bye Birdie. I made it to, I was one of the teenagers, but I didn't get a big part. But senior year, I played Luther Billis in South Pacific. Mm. So I had the big role, you know, the comic role. And this guy kept telling me, you should be an actor. And then I went to college and I hung around the drama department only because that's where the girls were, right? You know, so I hung around, but I really didn't get into it.
What were you going to school for, Tony?
To be a history teacher.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I wanted to be a teacher, and
how things come around.
Yeah, well, you know, but let me tell you what happened. So I graduate, and then I get out of school, and I'm too young to teach anybody anything. I mean, come on, give me a break. I was 20. What are you kidding me? I didn't have a great experience student teaching either. It was one of those things. Anyway, so I start taking odd jobs, doing, you know, whatever I
like could what? Do. Give me one.
Well, I shaped up for North American Airlines. I used to, you know, load furniture for mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was a bartender in a lot of places. I know, I really was bartender. And then I'm not that it was illicit trade, but I knew a guy who would give me some stuff and I would sell it at a trunk.
You knew a guy?
I knew a guy who knew a guy.
Sure, I'm familiar.
Anyway, those were my days. But and then back then, until about 1984, you know, you could get in a fight in America. You could hit somebody and you didn't get in trouble because it's the way we straighten things out. Well, that's how we did it, because that's what was on TV. See, now what's on TV is blah, 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 guns, so it's a different world. But back then, and I used to like to fight. I grew up in East New York and Brooklyn, where we fought every day. It was, fighting was another game we played. It's like, you want to play stickball today? Nah, come on, let's fight. And there was a menu of guys you could fight. So if you wanted to fight the black guys, you went to East New York Vocational High. You want to fight the Puerto Rican guys, you went to Logan and Fulton. You want to fight the white guys, you went to South. We hated them most, the South Ozone Park. And so every day it was fight. We got to the point, I'm not kidding you, we got to the point where we would choose a guy from each side and we'd all sit there and watch them fight. I mean, it became like a, you know.
So if you were, when you joined theater, that seems like as a tough guy, as a fighter, like, did people think, oh, well, we could take this guy, he's in theater? Like, was it part of like...
No, it didn't happen.
No?
And what happened was, one night, I owned a bar. I bought into a bar. And all my friends were hanging out there. And I was going out with this girl. It turned out she had, you know, Paul Bunyan was her boyfriend, you know. And he shows up. And he's looking at my friends and going, oh, it's going to happen tonight. He's going to get killed. But I won. I beat the guy up in the street. I beat him up. And I was, you know, I felt pretty good. So what they did was that next day they you know, in the old days, you could fill out an entry blank in the New York Daily News and enter the Golden Gloves. And so they filled it out and entered me. I'll be honest with you.
How soon after you took down Paul Bunyan?
It's a couple of weeks later. I get a notice for my physical. I thought I got drafted. I don't know what the hell's going on. Anyway, I went and I got into it. And the first year I did really well. I knocked out six guys. The guy in the Daily News called me the battling bartender. I served mittens instead of mittens.
Oh. Do you remember enjoying being the center of attention as a boxer?
Well, that's what I'm getting.
Being what?
That's what I'm getting to. So I was performing. I mean, it was a different kind. It was, by the way, it's what I was good at. I was good at that. You know, I could fight. I could always fight. And so then I turned pro. And then one day I'm training in Gleason's gym on 30th and 8th Avenue. And a guy walks in. And he's a brokester. But he's got this pilot he's trying to sell. And it's about a young fighter who works out at this old fighter's gym. And they have a relationship. And to pay the rent, they rent half of the place to an aerobics instructor. And I was thinking, geez, leg warmers. You know, I was, you know, I thought this is going to be great.
You got visions of Olivia Newton-John in your head. Yeah. Go on.
Yeah. He said to me, everything will be about on TV. And I said, well, yeah. And you got to remember, we're talking about back when being on TV was rarefied air.
Well, three networks. That was it back then.
Three networks, you know. So, you know, I thought he was up to something. I'll be honest with you. I didn't know what was going on. But then he invited me to his office. I came down. He had a little tiny office on Madison Avenue, the broom closet. Sit down, read the script. He says, and he goes, hey, you know, you're pretty good. He was like surprised I could read. You know, it was like weird. But anyway.
Wait, hold on. Sorry to interrupt. So you're sitting in the office and he's having you read the script for the first time in his office, just you and him in the broom closet?
It's like this little tiny office and we sit there and read the script. Yeah. You know,
wow.
And we read the script. It was called Augie, by the way. So that was it. I went home and I thought, he keeps calling me. He keeps calling me. And then finally he says to me, hey, I got you an agent. And he got me this agent, this guy, Stuart Jensen, a great guy, not with us any longer. And Stuart says to me, I think you should take some acting lessons and you should. I went to the Ansonia. It was the craziest thing I'd ever been to. It was like a haunted place. And I went in there. There was all these people singing in the hallways and stuff. But I took some lessons I went and I got the pilot.
But you're fighting and you're like,
I was still
in
fighting.
My spare time,
oh, yeah,
I'm going to take some lessons here. I'm going to try this out.
And fighting is how I end up. Because what happens is one night he says to me, hey, I got NBC guys interested in the pilot. I think if they could see you fight, we may be able to
close the deal. Yeah.
Yeah. I said, well, Stu, you know, you're not going to believe this, but I got to fight Friday. It was Wednesday. I said, I'm fighting Friday night. At night in Nyack at the Nanuet Star Theater. And he says, okay, I'm going to bring them. Do good. And he hangs up the phone. And I'm like, you know, I got enough problems. I needed this, you know.
I need more pressure.
I know. So anyway, that night, I fight this guy. His name was Rocky Garcia. Now, I never had trouble with guys named Rocky, by the way. You know what I mean? They just, yeah, okay, Rocky, boom. But anyway, Rocky Garcia, and he was the state champion of Connecticut. And so I'll never forget my trainer on the way there says to me, state champion of Connecticut? Well, how tough could he be? You know. So anyway, the bell rings. The two guys are up there. I see Stu. The two guys are the bell rings 30 seconds into the fight.
You're aware of them. You're like, you're warming up and you're aware of them.
I know they're there. Yeah, you know. And then, by the way, there was a whole bunch of other guys that were watching me. My manager had some people there. Again, anyway, the bell rings. And I think, I'm going to get this guy. I got to look good. I go out. And the guy's got this weird move where he looks like he's throwing the right hand, but he hits you with a left hook. And, you know, when you get hit with a left hook, your right hand drops you. The left hand picks you up and drops you on the back of your neck with your feet up in the air. And, you know, anytime in boxing, your feet are above your head, you're in bad shape.
Not good.
So here I am. I'm on the ground. I find myself on the canvas. Like, he's counting, and this guy's over there breathing fire, by the way, breathing fire. I jump up, and I go, I'll kill it. Oh, I'm going to get this guy. Hits me with the same punch. Down I go again. I'm down twice. In the first like 40 seconds. And this time I'm really hurt. I hear the referee count. It's like it slows down. It's like it's weird thing. One, three, oh, you know, it's
like you're underwater.
Yeah. And I look over at the guy. He's screaming. He's jumping up and down in the neutral corner, screaming, get up, get up. It's like that. And I'm thinking, you know, should I? I don't know. So anyway, I hear him say eight, and I get up. And I take, man, I'm telling you something. I got a film of it. It's hysterical. I take a terrible beating. The guy just hits me, boom, bang. I'm just getting killed. I'm walking around just following him, and he's just hitting and killing me. And this goes on like, and by the way, this is all in the first round, okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, so with 15 seconds left in the round, we both throw right hands, and mine gets there first. blink, I knock him out. And I mean, I tell you something. I was like, at the end of the fight on the film, you see me, I go over to him and I go, ah, you had, you know, I apologize to the guy. Like, you had me, man. I know, you know, I win the fight. And I really,
in dramatic fashion.
Yes. I wasn't even sure what the hell was going on. And I saw Stu, he said, oh, we're going to be great. You know, I saw him, he was so happy. But that fight, if I don't get up, I bet you I'm still sitting there.
Wow. But yeah. So much had to go right for you to have your career, right? Tony, you had to enter that competition, the Gold Gloves. You had to be in that gym. You had to go to that office. You had to have this fight.
Yeah, and then something else had to happen. So I got the job. And because I got the job, you know, I ended up, you know, the fighting, it really is a big part of my career. So I went and I did this pilot. It was called Fast Lane Blue. I flew out to California, put me up at the Sportsman's Lodge. I thought, where the hell I was?
Sure.
Koi
in the heart of Sherman Oaks.
The fish they were bringing. I never saw anything like that. I thought Ventura Boulevard was Ventura Highway. You know, I didn't know where it was. Anyway. That's so stupid. But I get the part. I get the part. And by the way, I've never heard the words, thank you very much, which plays later on in the story. But because nobody ever said thank you very much. They just said, oh, you're great. You're going to give me the part. So anyway, that's a whole, I digress. Anyway, the wind up of the story is I get the part. Because of that, this agent says to me one day, calls me up and says, hey, I want to send you on an open call for the Warriors. Remember that picture, boy?
Oh, yeah.
Sure. Of course.
All right.
You're perfect for it.
I know. So I go. Wait. I go. And I go. And it's an open call for the Warriors. Could you imagine in New York a gang picture? There's an open call. A lot of feathers. You had to see it. It was crazy. All right. But anyway. So now I get in. And it's a long conference table. At the end of the table is Larry Gordon, John Milius, and Joel Silver. I mean, you know, big guys making action pictures. And so I read, and he says to me, thank you very much. And I didn't know what that was, but I said to him, hey, by the way, so I was fighting my first main event, and I was at Prospect Hall, which is, do you remember that place? We make your dreams come true, a wedding place. Probably was the Grand Prospect Bowl.
Sure.
That used to be a fight club. And before that, it was an opera house. But it used to be a fight club. So I'm fighting my first main event. And remember those old posters where you know the names?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Movies move up as time flies by. Well, I had my picture. It was my first main event. I had my picture on it. It said Tough Tony Danza. Had me standing there. Brooklyn's knockout artist. So what I did was I went, hey, guys, you really want to see a warrior? And I unfurled the poster. I said, you guys should come see me fight.
You went in with the poster? You had the poster with you?
Yeah,
you brought the poster with you? Like you had forethought here?
Yeah, because I figured they want a warrior. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I opened the poster and they go crazy. They went, oh, we're coming. So Friday night, again, I'm fighting at Prospect Hall. And I was fighting a guy who we didn't like each other. We were in the same gym. And we knew we were going to fight each other. And I never thought he was a middleweight. I always thought he was a light heavyweight. And he was baloney and trying to get, you know. Yeah. But anyway, what was his name? I can't remember his name right now. But anyway.
Which is shocking, by the way, because you remember everything else. But it's remarkable.
Yeah, I can't remember. Anyway, so I was good. Jason, if you came to me, I was good because I liked the bang and I liked the brawl.
Mm-hmm.
If you ran around and were a cutie, I could look really bad, you know? And so this guy, we hated each other. We had an argument at the weigh-in. I mean, forget it. He comes right to me. And they sit through five boring fights. The bell rings on my fight. He comes right to me, hits me a right hand, and I come right off a left hook, and I land. When I tell you, I felt it in my toes. He spins around, goes up against the ropes, and in 40 seconds, he's in the first row. I knock him out of the ring.
Whoa.
So now I'm running around with all and I mean it was visceral because we didn't like each other too.
Mm-hmm.
And the referee didn't get there soon enough. He should have got there. I broke my hand on the guy's head. But anyway, I'm walking around the ring full of adrenaline, you know, and I see Larry Gordon, the great producer. He looks up and we make eye contact and he says, "That's the greatest audition I've ever seen." No, I get the part. They give me a part. They're going to keep me alive. I'm going to combine places and everything else. All of a sudden, I get a phone call from the agent. Oh, no, he says, "Okay, they want to see you at Gulf and Western." Remember when Gulf and Western, it's the Trump building now? Used to be Paramount on Gulf and Western. So I went to this giant building in the city to get cost, to get wardrobe. And now I'm doing, wait a minute. I was fighting in Prospect Hall for like, you get $800 for 10 rounds. And now here I am. I'm like, going to be in a big movie. Look at a girl. Everything was like, this was so, all of a sudden somebody tapped me on the shoulder. He says, "You Tony Danza?" And I went, I knew this was too good to be true, you know? He's, no, they want to see you in Julia Taylor and Gretchen Rennell's office. I said, "Who are they?" He's the casting guy people. He's where? 22nd floor. So I said, get in the elevator. Everything was fine. What do I need this for? I was doing great. I go to the 22nd floor. The doors open up to the elevator doors open to the waiting room. And in the waiting room, there's like 20 guys, 15, 20 guy actors, all blonde, like big guy, heavyweights, at least, you know, big guys. So the door opens, I'm standing there and I freeze. I'm just standing there. I said, "What the hell? Where do I go? What do I do?" Across the room is the receptionist. She's sitting there. She goes, "Are you Tony Danza?" And I go, "Yeah." She goes, "Oh, come on, they're waiting for you."
Did you have a headshot at this point, Tony?
No.
Nothing. He's got a fucking poster. Scar in his arm. That's what he's got. He's got scars on his arm. His fucking face is swollen.
So I'm walking by all these guys. They all got the signs. They're looking, they're practicing their lines. And they're like, "Who the hell is this idiot? You know, where did this guy come from?" Right. So I march in. I walk in, and there's two guys in there. I didn't know either one. I knew one of them, Mandy Patinkin, was in. He was reading for Judd's part, for Alex. And Jim Brooks, the great Jim Brooks. And when I tell you, when I say the great, I mean.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He is something else. Okay. Anyway, whatever the story is, I read with Mandy. And by the way, they were looking for a fight. I had a cast on my arm. I had a black eye. I mean, you know, it was like.
Let me just interrupt you for just a second. When you say you read, how much experience has you had just reading with someone other than sitting across in the broom closet on Madison Avenue?
I'm telling you. And you know what the bit was? The bit was is that we had a free phone. The quarter kept coming back. And we could call anybody we wanted in the world. And I remember for some reason my voice went up. When I said it, I said, hey, Alex, you want to go first? I said it like that. And he goes, no, you go ahead, Tony. So I call and I say, I want to reach this girl I met.
Wait, so the character's name was Tony Banta to begin with?
No, Phil Ryan.
What was his name?
Phil Ryan.
Phil Ryan. Okay. That goes better with the blonde-haired heavyweights out in the
exactly.
Waiting room.
the bit was, I want to call this girl. I met her, the classiest girl I ever met. I was in R&R when I was in Vietnam. You know, I met her in Thailand. Goes, yeah. Hello. Yeah. I'd like to speak to the VIP massage parlor. Yeah. I'd like to speak to number 12. Yeah. She's unbelievable girl. Classy. Then he goes, oh, no kidding. All right. Well, since the war's over, they only go up to 9. So that was the joke. And I get the part. And they change it from Phil Ryan to Phil Banta. And then they change it to Tony Banta. And I'll never forget. I thought they did it for me, and then I made a joke. I thought they're probably worried about my acting ability. I might not answer to Phil. You know what I mean? So Tony, they knew I'd answer at least.
So here you are on Taxi, right? You're about as green as they.
Wait a minute. Wait.
Again, please.
Let me tell you. This is what I was trying to tell you. The other thing that had to happen for me was I got Taxi, but it was them, the guys, the people. Mary Lou Judd, Danny, John, you know, they were actors who studied, who put in their time, who were knocking around Hollywood, and boom, they had this show. Holy crap. It was going to be number one. It was going to be on the number one network, ABC. It was going to be after the number one show, which was Three's Company. It was going to had the great time slot, and it had Brooks and all those writers from Mary Tyler Moore. So imagine. They were so excited. Oh, but wait, there's one thing. We found this boxer, fighter in New York. Well, he's never acted before professionally. But
he's going to be great.
I'm going to put him in the show. And, you know, I could imagine now if you said that to me now. But they welcomed me with open arms. And I mean it. I think it's the reason I was able to thrive, because there was never one ounce of resentment. In fact, Danny, you know, who's my, he's the man. Danny, he took me under his arm like right away. I was in an argument over a parking space. The first day I power back, I told me you can't park there. I said, this guy told me I could. I said, what are you, a cop? And then I get into a beef with.
So you've moved to Los Angeles at this point. You're in Hollywood. You're going to, you go, you're on,
I go to Hollywood. Hollywood.
You're going to Melrose, the Paramount lot.
They gave me money to, I drove up to them gates, Dan. Yeah. Forget about
it. Oh, can you imagine as a kid?
So I'm arguing with this guy. And all of a sudden I felt somebody tug on my sleeve. I turned around, and there's little guys next to me. And he says to me, you know, you're Tony Danza's, yeah. I think you're with me. So I'm Danny DeVito, come on. And that's how I met him, and I've been with him ever since, you know.
So what was the, I know that there was a very small, brief period between the end of Taxi and the beginning of Who's the Boss. What was that period like? Did you already know that you had another show lined up?
No, I was devastated too. I remember, I was thinking, I used to do this thing. I'd go into the mirror, don't they see? You know, why can't I get a job? You know,
now at this moment, were you like listening to people like, yeah, you gotta go into movies, you gotta do more dramatic things?
There was so much of that.
Yeah,
it was so much. By the way,
you can't do another sitcom. You've got to grow. You've got to change.
No. At that time, I was sitcom material. They wanted me to in a sitcom. They offered me three pilots. In one, I was a daring helicopter pilot. In another, I was a tough New York City detective. And in the third, I was a housekeeper for a woman, her mother, and her son. I said, I could be funny in that, because I wanted to be funny. And that's how I ended up in Who's the Boss.
Did any of those other shows end up going anywhere?
I don't know. I really don't. I'm not even sure. I never followed up. But, you know, I was like, I think I could be funny, you know, and that's really what I really wanted to do.
And then
do.
Did you realize once you were doing Who's the Boss for, what was it, 12 years? How long did you do that?
Eight years,
yeah. Did you go, did you talk to enough actors at that point going, wait, so you went from Taxi to Who's the Boss and you've been employed the entire time? And you're like, yeah.
First 15 years of my career, I worked 14 years.
Wow.
Straight. So I'm, you know, it was, by the way, you know, you've had dips and
yeah, ups and downs, of course. Yeah,
you know, everybody has, but I was really, really lucky up front early.
What about teaching?
I really think about the way I grew up, the life I had, and then this thing that happened to me, which, by the way, you know, garbage man's son from Brooklyn, two-bit fighter, you know, selling stuff out of the back of his car. You, there's got to be something I got to do for that. You know what I mean? I got to, you know, it's almost like if you don't, you're going to get in trouble.
You're going to pay it forward.
You got to do something. So yeah. So this thing, but it's really about the childhood I had and comparison to the childhood a lot of these kids have. It bums me out.
Well, that's actually why I brought up dinners at the beginning, Tony, because nowadays so many kids aren't able to sit down with their families and have dinners.
Let me tell you how bad. One of the things you find out when you work with kids is they don't know what they don't know. You know, it doesn't matter that we all know it. They don't know it. So we started acting, voice, dance, and, in college. College is our really big thing. And trying to get them in. And get them the financing.
Just for people, just so people understand a little bit what Stars of Tomorrow is, can you give us a little thumbnail just so they get it?
It's a teen acting program that we started, me and Brian Hills, who I met at the All Stars Project when I first came back to New York in 2011. I wanted to volunteer. I was dying to buy someone. I was dating this girl. She said to me, you know, there's this place on 42nd Street and 10th Street. I went and I got involved there teaching kids acting, but really teaching kids about life.
Was part of this, Tony, like that you never got to fulfill that, the history teacher aspect of who you were as well?
I got, yeah, that, and I got more of that. I got more, but the beauty of it is that, you know, the slogan of the program is, you know, when you teach a kid how to act, you teach a kid how to act.
You know, having had acting teachers myself, you know, Tony, what's interesting about it is there's such a parallel between coaching and being an acting teacher, or being a teacher, especially an acting teacher. There's such a parallel between coaching and that I've noticed.
But it's the greatest way to learn something is try to teach it. You know what I mean? That's really what it comes down to. But So I was working there for a couple of years. It's called Youth Development Through Performance. Pretty good. So I worked there a couple of years, and then we went to the police athletic league. We were there for 8 years. We engaged about 5,000 kids, got 220 something in college and finished.
So before you know it, you're completely involved, and this is a huge part of your life. Right.
And now I got a 501c3, and now we're on our own because I love the police athletic league. I was a PAL kid when I was 12. But I think we have to be more interested in the young teens, in high school kids. They're the ones picking up the guns. Mm-hmm. So I'm worried about them. PAL gets a lot of money from the government for preschool. And don't get me wrong, preschool's huge, big. But it's more urgent, I think, in the high school ages. Anyway, speaking of teaching, so, you know, when I could smell 60, which I would long for now, that smell. But anyway, I'm going to say I can smell 60. But anyway, I was thinking, I had this romantic notion about teaching, and I wanted to see what was going on in public education, because the conventional wisdom is there's nothing good going on, right? So I got a job. I taught 10th grade English at Northeast High School in Philadelphia. 3,500 kids. Any Vikings in the house?
Well, hold on. Wait a minute. Pump the brakes. Wait a minute. So you're living in the city and you're going to you're moving to Philadelphia to teach high school?
Yeah. I moved to Philadelphia, lived in the neighborhood, Cotman and Algon, and taught 10th grade English, ironically. But it was, you know, it was life fulfilling. I never did anything harder.
How were you able to do this in your Tony Danza? How does this work? Please explain.
Well, they didn't know who I was at first.
That can't be true.
What, are you kidding me? I got a recognition quotient. Thank God for raising Canaan. It's lowering it. Because, you know, I walk into a restaurant, I see a 40-year-old guy at the maitre d's table.
That's it.
I'm in.
That's it.
I'm in. I got a table.
That's it.
I see a 22-year-old guy or a girl. I'm like, geez.
I'm familiar. I'm familiar.
I got a quotient.
But still, you're teaching. I mean, you're moving to a city. You're now an English teacher. You walk in. There's other teachers there. They're like, you don't think word's going to travel quickly?
Oh, no. Let me tell you. I was earnest. I cried a lot. And it was the hardest job. I'm telling you, I learned, I wrote a book about it. I actually wrote a book. I wrote the whole, just another thing I actually did. I can't get over it.
Anyway. I'm not shocked by anything you do. I mean, you're fearless. It's unbelievable.
You ready for it? I got great titles. Don't Fill Up on the Antipasta. And this one's called, I Want to Apologize to Every Teacher I Ever Had My Year at Northeast.
including Mr. Messenger?
You know why? Because he was right. I never forget. So stupid I was. I was with him. I think we had gone to see a show. And he went into his normal routine about telling me I should be an actor. I look what we saw tonight, and you could. And I said, chick, there's a lot of good actors, but there's only one champion of the world. That's where I was. I was going to be champion of the world. And so Mr. Messenger, but now he's gone, unfortunately. But he saw me do a lot of stuff, and I'm real happy about that. And, you know, one of the things he used to always talk about when we were kids, I'm in the 11th grade, he would come home, he would come to class and tell us about the Cafe Carlyle at the Carlyle Hotel in New York City. Bobby Short and Cafe Society, who was there, who wasn't there? I would be like, oh, my God, this is unbelievable. And now I play the Carlyle. And I would say when I finish, I just wish Mr. Messenger could see me.
Oh, that's great. But I'm a big, like, universe guy, Tony, and, like, looking at messages. And the fact that his name was Messenger and he gave you this message, there's something there.
Yeah, yeah. Which, of course, totally escaped me when I was a kid. You know what I mean?
It escaped me till 2 seconds ago. So you're at Northeastern University. You're teaching. All of a sudden, you realize that there's a fucking problem, right? You're noticing, just with what is available to these high school kids, with what they're dealing with.
Not only that, but they don't know what they're missing. You know, did we go back to that thing again? They don't know. I mean, the fact that those dinners with my father and mother every night were so important. And the whole block was my village. Everybody knew me. The guy in the grocery store used to cross me, you know, make me cross the street. I mean, it was a different,
mentality time,
because people are so desperate now. It's so, you know, hey, by the way, let's be realistic. Let's really be honest. We had a survey in New York a few months ago that said 50% of New Yorkers. And we're all in this together if you live in New York. But 50% of New Yorkers can't make ends meet. And lately they've revised it and said that actually 50% are living in poverty. So when you have that kind of a situation, how can you have a safe, peaceful, happy city? So many people are desperate. And I'm not excusing any of these bums. Don't get me wrong. I'm sorry. I'm not excusing all this other stuff. But desperation causes you to make some bad choices, you know?
How do they get involved with your program? Like, how do they
sign up? We solicit it to high schools. We go to the high schools, and the high schools are so starved for arts that they're dying to help, you know, dying to help us. And we tell them it's free. The only thing is you got to come to the city. You got to get out of that six-block area that you live in. You got to, you know, navigate the city, you know, and actually see what this is about. You know, because I remember when I was a kid in East New York and Brooklyn, if you told me we were going to Manhattan, I had to pack a bag. That's like a day trip. What are you, you know? So these kids, and it goes back to that, what they know, they don't know. So Neil and I have been doing, and this goes back to dinners. So we put a wellness component in the program. So basically what we do now is we're going next week. We take them shopping. We take them shopping and show them how to buy food, what you need to make it. And then we go in on a Zoom. I make the food with them. We all make the food together.
In an air fryer, I'm guessing, and a Tony's macaroni in the air fryer.
I'm cognizant of the fact that a lot of them.
So,
now what, the next thing you're going to do is teach them footwork? I mean, what is going on over here?
Oh, by the way, we have the PAL tap dance ensemble, believe me. But no, they love it. They go crazy over it. And they're clamoring for meatloaf now. That right now at this point. They're like, when are we doing meatloaf?
And when you started this, were you like the acting teacher? Were you the
No, Brian and I. Brian and I. Brian Hills is the kid whisperer. He really is. He's like this. I don't know how he does it. Like a really rough kid will come because it's free. I'll be an actor. I'll be a tough guy actor. So they come. Now they walk in, they look, they say, oh God, I'm not doing this. And then they'll see some kids from another borough. That's enough to chase them. And, you know, kids are crazy. Anyway.
It's so true, though. It's so
you
true.
Go to the kid, you want to do it? No, I'm just watching. No, I just want to watch. Yeah. And this goes on for a few days. He stays with Brian a couple of days. I'm not kidding you. The next time you talk to him, he says, I have to support my ensemble. I'm not kidding. That's the kind of metamorphosis we see. And it works.
But you also must get a lot of kids coming in there saying, well, I don't need to learn how to act. I'm going to be a internet sensation, you know, that kind of stuff. And then they're learning different aspects of performance.
But we don't do that. We do is acting. We do. You can't believe, you want to know something? You can't believe how these kids love Shakespeare. We did a thing this summer on Governor's Island. We got a little headquarters out there. And we were just spending time on Governor's Island. Kids went crazy. You know, we're still in New York. It's the craziest thing. You take the one down to South Ferry. You walk 5 minutes. You get on not even a 10-minute ferry ride, and you're someplace else. It's the crazy, and it's fabulous. So we had this thing out there. So we started doing shows called Shakespeare with a 90s twist. So Shakespeare raps. Shakespeare actually raps at times. You know, he goes back and forth. But you would not believe how they love Shakespeare. It's incredible. So instead of like that social media baloney that you're talking about, the opposite is true. And like I got three kids this semester graduating from the conservatory, the acting conservatory at Purchase, at SUNY Purchase.
Wow.
I mean, it really works, you know. It just really works. And we owe it to them. You know, we think about this for a second. Now, this is my pet. Here's my pitch. It seems to me that we have abdicated any responsibility for taking care of nurturing our children because, you know, there used to be, remember, there was a TV hour, a family hour. We could only watch certain things and we'd watch what they see and where they bought. Now they're customers just like us. And that's all bets are off. Watch what you want, buy what you want, do what you want. And I think they're getting cheated. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, and by the way, this is private and public. I mean, everybody's sort of giving up on it. So I just think it would be good to give them something else to zero in, to just be interested in. You know, a lot of the stuff that you see on TV and in the movies and in music is all about the self. It's not, you know what I mean? It's don't mess with me, my sneakers. You know, it's wrapped in social justice and it's wrapped in female empowerment, but it's about don't mess with
and
me.
Also, there's so much isolation because
exactly
that's the other part of it.
But it's very hard if you're thinking like that to resolve conflicts without going to the guns. So this is all I'm saying. You know, try to be part of something bigger than yourself. Wow. How about that for a thought?
Well, and that's what I was going to say, Tony, is that you are clearly these kids are getting something out of the program, but it sounds like you are too.
Oh, sounds like he is. Are you kidding? He's got like a third purpose in life. He just came up with
people tell me it's really good what you're doing. I say to them, what are you nuts? It's good for me. It makes me feel like I'm doing something. And I told you earlier, I better. I noticed, you know. I know. I got it. I'm doing it. You know, I feel very, and I love it. I got to tell you, I love it. I just did a little monologue in a play at Town Hall. I had a whole bunch of the kids call me watch. And it's just amazing, you know. And then I took a bunch of kids to see Danny DeVito's play. He's probably going to get a Tony nomination tomorrow. But anyway, I went to see his play on Broadway, took the kids, and then he and his daughter, who was in the play with him, Lucy, they came out and talked to the
kids.
Oh,
what a treat.
Danny's so generous.
So right after his performance, they've just seen him, and now they get to have the conversation. Oh, that's terrific. That's terrific. What a treat. I hope they know what a treat that is to be able to.
They absolutely do. I mean, you got to see, that's the thing. The kids are so inquisitive and so... And well informed about what they were seeing. They asked the greatest questions. I took them to see Piano Lesson with Sam Jackson too. And Sam, I did a movie with him. I don't know how many years ago. It was a TV movie where I shot him. And he called me by my when I walked in, he's not going to remember me. He says to me, "Hey, Gus Faraci." That was my character name. So the kids went crazy. You know Sam Jackson. You know, I was a big shot for the day.
We got a listener question for you, which is a funny listener question because it's really not about you, but I love that they came up with this. JP asks, "I'm a younger person who never got to see Taxi when it was on the air. However, as a comedy lover, Andy Kaufman has become a mysterious and iconic figure to everyone. As a co-star, could you get to know him? Was he mysterious as he seemed?" They want to know about Andy Kaufman, Tony.
The thing that I would say about Andy, first of all, you know, he would love that we're asking this question.
Actually,
Andy really wanted you to wonder. He wanted you to think, what's going on here? And that's what he did. And nobody was better at it. And yes, I want you to know he wasn't my favorite guy. You know, we were a team. He didn't rehearse. You know, he ate seaweed in his car. He was meditating. I mean, you know, we actually had a guy who did him. He didn't rehearse with us. We had a guy who did Andy. It was really, you know. So at first I was like that. But as I got to know him, I realized what he was and what a genius. He really was a genius.
Wait, so Jim would be setting up the shots and you'd be working on tape. You'd be doing tape rehearse day and Andy wouldn't be there? There'd be somebody else doing the blocking?
He came Tuesday and Friday. He came Tuesday for the crew and Friday for the show. I'm not kidding. It was unbelievable. And by the way, not once in the gag reel. Never made a mistake.
Wow.
Never made a mistake. And I don't know if you remember. Do you remember what he did on camera? I mean, I don't think people
Are you
remember.
Kidding what? Me? Are you kidding?
Two guys did this on Taxi. Two guys did this. On camera, turned into a different guy in front of your eyes. He turned from Latka Gravis to Vic Ferrari.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the most incredible, seamless... It was like Star Trek. Somebody shot him and he transformed or something. And the other guy to do that is the other great, great actor. And one of the, man, I want to tell you, I love this guy so much. He's one of the greatest guys, Chris Lloyd.
Oh, my God.
And Chris changed from the college student. He was wearing his Yale leather sweater. And he eats a bite of an Alice B. Toklas brownie. And that's the start of Reverend Jim. And he turns into Reverend Jim right on camera. I mean, I can't tell you how hard that is. You know, Dan. Yeah,
no, first of all, especially when you do it flawlessly like that.
Flawlessly.
For your first job to have these people to study, it's like an acting school.
Boom, right on the nose.
So let me ask you this, because I don't know the story, but like there's two things. Every kid that I know, I'd show them two things on YouTube. The first thing is who's on first. Because they don't know who's on first, yes. Right? So I show them that. And the second thing is, what does a yellow light mean?
Did that just go on and on? I mean,
well, you know, let me tell you something. Somebody almost got, the director almost got fired because they, the producer, Jim Brooks and Ed Weinberg, they didn't want it stopped because the audience kept laughing.
I was going to, you could have done it 18 times.
Yeah, but they didn't, they almost fired him for that. It wasn't long enough for them.
I've never seen a joke work so well.
Yeah, 45 years later, we're talking about
it. That was my listener question. The question that I wanted. Those are the two things I show because it's the fun. Those are the two things that are the funniest things I've ever seen in my life.
Jason hit it on the head, though. You know, I was lucky, so lucky to end up with that group. Not only did I was going to acting school. I mean, not only did they take me in, but they showed.
Yeah, you could have had a much different experience with a group that wasn't as welcoming, and then maybe it turned you off to the industry.
And by the way, all I needed was somebody to tell me you can't do this, and I would have I might have taken my shoes for a walk. Mm-hmm. Told me I could do it.
Well, and that's what you're doing for kids today, which is you're giving it back.
Yeah, I mean, what a wonderful thing! What a wonderful example to be like. Oh, I don't know, I can't do Hollywood. I can't. I'm never going to be an actor. Blah blah. I mean, look at your own experience and go. Funny you should say that.
Yes. And by the way, before you let me go, Kanan, I just want to tell you, this show is unbelievable.
By the way, you're terrific in it. I saw a scene with you and Rispoli. Rispoli played my brother. Rispoli's
great. By the way, that's why I did the show. Because
I'm crazy about Rispoli.
They said, you know, the other actor's Michael Rispoli. I said, I'm doing it.
And you're getting to play a role that you normally don't get to play.
I got to say these words last week on camera. Hey. When I find out who's responsible for this, somebody's going to be wearing cement slippers. And then the guy says to me, geez, I hope they don't come in my size. And I say to him, it's one size fits all, Mark.
Oh, man. I just didn't want to stop. Like, literally, he was fine. He could have kept going. He's like, well, before you guys let me go, I'm like, I'm not letting you go. You go. You keep going.
No, I know.
I can imagine his publicist, Jill, sitting there going, okay, guys, wrap it up. He's got a life. Let's go. And I'm like, no. I want to hear more. I love his passion. I mean, when he was talking about teaching, it was just so good. You could see it in his face for the listener. You could see it in his face. He you know, if you turn the sound down, he could have been talking about anything that he's crazy about.
Well, and I think that's what we didn't set out to do this when we started the podcast, but really our podcast has become about passions. We talk to people and we can, because it's a subject that they care about, their passion comes through. And it's like, it's really one of those things that kind of has inspired me. Cause after we talk to somebody like Tony, who is so in love with what he's doing, it makes you want to go out and do something you love.
But yeah, no, I totally agree. It's like you can see that people have purpose, man. When they have purpose, one of the things that I loved about Tony is, you know, to him, whether he talked about doing Raising Kanan, whether he talked about his experience with Taxi, whether he talked about boxing, whether he talked about teaching, whether he talked about making meatballs, whether he talked about making sauce, whether he talked about his air fryer, they were all the same thing. It was all just, I love this. This is the totality of my life. And I think a lot of people get into, you know, I just have to talk about one thing, or, this is the thing that defines me. And listening to somebody like him, it all defines him. It's all part of who he is.
Yeah. And I wonder too, like, so he's the same age as my dad. My dad is in a nursing home. He's ill. He doesn't have that same kind of zeal. Like, I wonder if that's part of, because Tony doesn't look 73. He doesn't look like, he doesn't look like my dad's age. And I wonder if part of that is like his enthusiasm and zeal for life is just carrying through to his the way he's living his life.
Well, I think there's something, Jason, to be said for purpose and passion. You know, and talking, you know, when he's talking about expanding Stars of Tomorrow, you can see that that's going to keep him going.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to keep him going. When he's excited about doing another season of Raising Kanan, that keeps you going. I mean, it makes you get up in the morning, makes you excited about stuff. It's like, you know, for me, there's so many things that I really enjoy. And it took time to figure out what those things were. Now I just love them.
It's spending time with me.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
That I love spending. Well, I do enjoy it. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I love doing this podcast. I love talking to people. I love researching it. I never thought that would be. I thought this would be tedious and awful and I was doing you a favor. That is not what has happened. Thank God I don't listen to me most of the time. And thank God you guys are listening. Really appreciate it.
Music by Denny Nucci. Produced and edited by the same two people you heard hosting this show, because they have no friends.